Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Lin was the last person to add his verse to it. And it felt like his voice needed to be in here somewhere. And that was the appropriate place, you know, to do it.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you try to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 179, a talk with DJ J Period. J Period is one of the best mixtape DJs in the world, and if you didn't already know, worked closely with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Questlove on the just-released Hamilton mixtape. He's also been the music supervisor for the Brooklyn Nets, helped launch the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, produced for TV and film, and was even the DJ Spike Lee called at 10 a.m. the day Prince passed to come play his block party that night. J Period began DJing while in college at Stanford, but soon turned from solely rocking parties into developing his unique mixtapes. His work is very far from a standard tape. Instead, J Period makes musical documentaries, mixing songs, interview and news footage, sample sources, and guest artists to create a unique, multi-layered picture of the work of icons like Nas, Lauryn Hill, Q-Tip, James Brown, Michael Jackson, and more. He even sits down to interview artists for his tapes. And in fact, I began our talk by asking him the question he famously begins with: what was playing in your house when you were growing up? J Period has also taken this approach to the stage with his live mixtape series, which he has performed tons of places, including the Smithsonian, the Roots Picnic, and the Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival. As if all that wasn't enough, just last week, he released perhaps his biggest project yet. J Period co-produced and curated the Hamilton mixtape, a companion to the smash hit musical that mixes new versions of songs in the show, reinterpretations, and demos in the way only he can. We talked to J Period at his studio in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. As you heard from our producer Josh last week, we're sponsored for the month of December by Meza Headphones. He's the headphone nut. I just know what I think sounds and looks great. Meza was nice enough to send us a few pairs to test out over the month. We'll share our impressions of them with you, and if you think you'd be interested, you should definitely check them out too. I've finally gotten a week to listen to my pair, and man, they are amazing. The mix is unbelievable. I've heard parts in music I know well that I never knew existed. From doubled vocals on Tech N9ne songs to both drummers on early 70s Allman Brothers live gigs. Listening to music on these things sounds like you're in the studio listening to playback with the producer. When I was listening to Hamilton while putting this show together, it felt like I had front row seats at the theater. Josh swears he saw my eyes pop out of my head in the first 30 seconds I had them on. For more information, head over to meze.thecyphershow.com. That's meze.thecyphershow.com to find out more information about the company and the headphones. And thanks for supporting us. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the only mixtape DJ who managed to get a drop from Ms. Hill, DJ J Period. What was playing in your house when you were a kid?
Wow. You're going to ask me my own question. I love it. What was playing in my house when I was a kid? Music all the time. My dad was actually a folk musician. So from him, I got Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Simon and Garfunkel, Leonard Cohen, Peter, Paul, and Mary, stuff like that. My mom was into, you know, rock and roll. So it was Beatles, Stones, Chuck Berry. She would famously tell me stories of sneaking out of her parents' house in Newark and going up to shows at the Apollo when she was a kid. And, you know, from my sister, who was 5 years older, I got Fishbone, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Led Zeppelin. So, you know, I really got a mixture of everything. But My dad used to just make up songs. So everything was always a song. Like every situation, he would make up a song for that situation. So, you know, music was a constant for me in my childhood.
What did he play?
He played guitar and he sang and he wrote songs. At one point in his youth, he actually had a songwriting deal with Warner Chappell. Before he went on to, you know, his teaching career. But yeah, he would, you know, also sort of write songs for occasions, in our family, you know, birthday, bar mitzvah, you know, et cetera. He would write songs.
That's awesome. And where did he teach?
He taught, a couple places, but mainly a small, independent school in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So you grew up in LA, mm-hmm. obviously, before making it to New York. Let's actually start with something a little more recent and kind of work backwards.
Okay.
The Hamilton mixtape, since it's coming out Friday.
Yep.
Huge deal.
Yep.
Obviously, you know, minus the handful of crazies who were boycotting it, you know, Hamilton is the biggest thing in the universe.
In spite of a recent right-wing call for a boycott of Hamilton because an audience booed Vice President-elect Mike Pence, the show broke the all-time Broadway record for single-week receipts during Thanksgiving week 2016.
How did you first get involved with the mixtape?
I mean, the first call I got was about, I want to say, close to a year and a half ago, 2 years ago maybe even, which was right after the play had opened up on Broadway. And it was a guy named Riggs Morales, who ended up being the A&R for the project.
Hip-hop heads may remember Rigo Riggs Morales from his 1995 to 2001 tenure at The Source. He went on to work for Paul Rosenberg's Goliath Management, Shady Records, and Atlantic Records.
And, you know, he told me about the play, which I'd heard only a little bit about, and basically said that the original title of the play was The Hamilton Mixtape. And he wanted me to go see it and then, you know, have a conversation. So I went and I saw it and I was blown away by it. I mean, like everybody who has seen it has right. been. And then things sort of got quiet for a while because it went from being this, you know, awesome play to this, you know, cultural phenomenon. And over the course of the, you know, year and a half since, that mixtape idea transformed into an album, you know, where Usher and Alicia Keys and Andra Day and all these people are remaking songs from the play. And it came back to me through Questlove from The Roots, who I work with a lot. You know, they had, you know, finished making all the songs and they wanted it to sound and feel like a mixtape. And Amir, you know, said, you're the guy for that. So they called me in to Electric Lady Studios and it was literally Amir handing me his phone and on FaceTime was Lin-Manuel Miranda. And, you know, he says, you know, he's like, how much do you know about the play? And I said, well, I know a lot about the play. He said, have you heard any of the songs from the mixtape? And I said, no. He said, all right, you know, we'll send them to you, listen to them, and sort of call me back. And that was the beginning of this crazy period of time
right.
with me, you know, 24-hour days working on the Hamilton mixtape.
Wow. So the stuff you got, was that kind of just the songs that were remakes of stuff in the show?
Yeah. So they, you know, they sort of sent me a download link to all of the rough versions. I mean, and this was also, you know, a bit of a moving target because they're deciding on which versions of which songs they want and which songs while we're doing all of this. So I came into this sort of mid-flow. And, you know, the label had their idea of a song order, and Lin had his idea of a song order that I think was more grounded in the show, you know, narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in with a slightly different take on it. And, you know, I sort of thought to myself, the only really way to do this is to just make it. And so I literally, the first night I spoke to him, sat in Electric Lady, and I made a mock-up of the whole mixtape as I heard it in my head. And that, you know, framework ended up really becoming the mixtape in its final form, you know, with a lot of tweaking, obviously. But yeah.
That's amazing. And so how did the hip-hop songs get involved? The ones where it's kind of like they'll take a phrase from the show or whatever and kind of put their own spin on it.
Don't be shocked when your history book mentions me. I will lay down my life if it sets us free. Eventually you'll see my ascendancy. And I am not thrown away my shot. I am not thrown away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot.
So I'm unapologetic. I want my calisthenics. If I have given it all I got, I cannot regret it. My point of destination's different from where I was headed. Cause I'ma shoot for the stars to get it. I shot, not throwing away my shot. I said I'm not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I said I'm not throwing away my shot.
you had a little more to do with that just based on the artists who were on it.
Well, yeah, there were some that were already sort of in progress. There were a couple that came in. The first song, No John Trumbull, Black Thought had recorded over a beat by produced by a group called The Works that he works with, and I took that and remixed it and remade it.
You ever seen a painting by John Trumbull? Founding fathers in a line looking all humble, patiently waiting to sign a declaration and start a nation, no sign of disagreement, not one grumble.
John Trumbull was the painter of the famous image of the signing of the Declaration of Independence that you're probably imagining right now, and wound up on the back of the $2 bill. The original version of No John Trumbull was in the first off-Broadway production of Hamilton, but was cut when it moved to Broadway. This is what it sounded like.
You ever see a painting by John Trumbull? Founding fathers in a line, looking all humble, patiently waiting.
I also, you know, took a sample from the play. I thought it was really important to bridge the gap between the play and these new versions of the songs, both kind of from a narrative standpoint and also musically. If Usher's going to do Wait For It, I want to mix into the version from the play, you know, filtered, and then, you know, mix into the Usher version.
Theodosia writes me a letter every day.
So there was a lot of adding the kind of DJ aesthetic and those sorts of things to it. But a lot of these songs had been in progress for a while. You know, there were certain songs that had maybe a rapper on it and that rapper switched to another one, or, you know, other things like that based on who had the best performance. But, you know, the thing was, in the time since I started, you know, having the conversation and to where it ended up, a lot of this became big pop ballads. So part of the challenge of the mixtape was making it feel like a hip-hop mixtape while you're going back and forth between Busta Rhymes and Sia.
I remember that night, I just might regret that night for the rest of my days. I remember those soldier boys tripping over themselves when I praise. I remember that dream like candlelight, like a dream that you can't quite place. But Alexander, I'll never forget the first time I saw your face.
Or, you know, Kelly Clarkson.
Or Kelly whatever. Clarkson.
Yeah. Take the children to church on Sunday. The cross at the door, and I pray it never used to happen before.
I mean, I think the challenge and the great accomplishment of, you know, of the final version of it is that, you know, it really flows, you know, from Kelly Clarkson, you know, into Alicia Keys.
Grant you peace of mind if you could let me inside of your heart.
Sort of, you know, and all around. So, you know, I think you had to bridge a lot of gaps because the roots of this thing are hip hop, clearly, but it's gotten to a level where, you know, it's massive. And so that became one of the challenges, but I think we did a great job.
Yeah. And I want to dig in just to one or two of the songs on it.
Okay.
First off, I couldn't help noticing, you know, completely reasonably, and I think something anyone would have done, Lynn put himself on the song with Nas.
Mm.
Dubbing in these rhymes in my dual cassette deck, running out of time like I'm Jonathan Lawson's rent check. My mind is where the wild things are, Maurice Sendak. In withdrawal, I want it all. Please give me that pen back, y'all.
How did that song kind of come together?
That song in particular was on a list of sort of maybes, and it wasn't in its finished form. There were a couple verses that needed to be changed still. And I heard that track, which, you know, Illmind produced, and I thought, this is the best one of all of them to me, you know, just sort of off top. It's now hard for me to choose because there's so many good ones.
Right.
But I felt that it was really important for that to go in there. And then the process from there was sort of people tweaking their verses, and Lynn was the last person to add his verse to it. And it felt like his voice needed to be in here somewhere. And that was the appropriate place, you know, to do it, because this metaphor of writing my way out of my circumstances applies to Alexander Hamilton. It applies to Nas.
I picked up the pen like Hamilton. street analyst. Now I write words and try to channel them. No political.
They're Dave East.
I persevered. Composition, I kept it close. Competition near. I'm a Spartan without the spear. 300 rhymes. It was written before I wrote it. Opportunity knocking. Might miss it. That window closing.
Or Lynn. So it was like sort of the perfect one for his voice to be in there.
I know Abuela's never really gonna win the lottery, so it's up to me to draw blood with this pen, hit an artery. This Puerto Rican's brains are leaking through the speakers, and if he can be the shining beacon, this side of the GW being shine a light when it's gray out.
I wrote my way out.
And I was a big proponent of having his voice somewhere on this mixtape.
Mm-hmm. And what about the immigrants? We get the job done with Riz MC, who's now a big star all of a sudden in Star Wars movies. I don't know if that was the case when this project started with him.
Rizwan Riz Ahmed, who raps under the name Riz MC, is also an actor who has lately gained notice as the star of the HBO series The Night Of. He will appear in the upcoming film Rogue One, a Star Wars story.
You know, Immigrants was another one where I think it's gone through many iterations and changed over time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea in this moment in history, obviously with you know, a lot of the sort of political ramifications of that song.
Right. And that line in particular, which, you know, when the vice president-elect showed up, obviously that line in particular got a big response as a sort of acknowledgement of his administration's ideas on immigration.
We're finally on the field. We've had quite a run.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
I mean, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. Like, yeah. You know, say what you will, but there's no way of avoiding that. And I think that that song in particular, you know, is a great reminder of that. And I think you had to get voices from all over the world. You had to get Snow the Product and Riz and Kanan and everybody on there.
It's a hard line when you're an import, baby boy. It's hard times when you ain't sent for braces, feed the belly.
AOA, immigrants, we don't like that. Nah, they don't play. British Empire strikes back.
I got one job, two jobs, three when I need them.
Tierra por agua, identidad falsa. Brincamos muros o flotamos en balsa. La peleamos como Sandino en Nicaragua. Somos como las plantas que crecen sin agua.
Because, you know, that's what it's all about. It's like this is a universal experience of, you know, that immigrant experience, and it's so closely tied to the American experience. So it's like it's got to be in there, and then it's got to bang. You know, like that song just hits. Yeah. Really hard.
Who these Fugees? What do they do for me? But contribute new dreams, taxes, and tool swagger and booty. Cool, they flee war zones, but the problem ain't ours. Even if our bombs landed on them like the Mayflower.
And then, you know, little known fact, which I'll give you, the news report at the beginning of that track on the mixtape.
You know, when it gets into this whole issue of border security, and, you know, who's going to say that the borders are secure? We've got the House and the Senate debating this issue, and it's really astonishing that in a country founded by immigrants, immigrant has somehow become a bad word. So the debate rages on.
I had been inspired by real news reports, but that voice is actually mine. So I am playing the part of the news reporter in there, sort of framing what you're about to hear, you know, with which is that this discussion about immigration, people seem to forget, you know, that we are a nation of immigrants.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Amazing. And what was, as far as those kinds of tracks, the hip-hop tracks, and I guess the overall scope of the thing, what was Lynn's involvement?
In terms of what?
Looking at the rap tracks, in terms of what people were saying, right, in terms of the artists and, you know, hey, I want you to say this on a verse or have it on this theme or anything like that. What was his involvement? What was your involvement? How much did you kind of guide the MCs?
I mean, to my understanding, he let the MCs do what the MCs were going to do. I mean, I think there's a certain level of quality control that goes into any project like this where you're listening to verses. And if a verse isn't, you know, up to snuff, maybe someone goes back in the studio and does another one. But I think he let the MCs really do their thing. I mean, you have to remember this whole thing was inspired by his love of hip hop and many of those MCs who are on there in particular. So Busta, you know, Nas, you know, Black Thought, like those are all people that were in his head when he was writing the play to begin with. So I think, you know, when you get the opportunity, you let those guys do their thing.
Right. And I thought it was a cute moment to have Busta on there when, you know, one of the characters' rap styles is very based on Busta.
Rawr, like a dungeon dragon. Change your little jaws with your pants are sagging.
Brah, brah, I am Hercules Mulligan. Up in it, loving it. Yes, I heard your mother said, come again.
Hey. Which is something he shouts out in his verse. So it kind of comes full circle in that way.
Earth, and now I come again, holding down Hamilton.
Yeah, and again, it's like the thing I love most about Hamilton and what I really tried to do with, you know, producing the mixtape is that it operates on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have these little nods to things like that, you know, which if you saw the play, you get. But, you know, regardless, like, you're just into Busta and you come to appreciate Busta just from the way he sounds on the track if you didn't know who he was and that he inspired, you know, Hercules Mulligan's character.
Right. And I guess finally about that, I'm sure you had access to lots of sort of Hamilton rarities putting this together, you know, demos and who knows what. What was some stuff that didn't end up making it onto the tape as far as things in that world that you
well, there are a couple of incredible demos on there. Valley Forge, which actually, and in that you'll hear elements that were extracted that ended up in other songs, if you know the Cast album.
I have never seen His Excellency so despondent, so I've taken over writing all his correspondence. I have written Congress and received dishonest responses. I am beyond comprehension of their nonsense. They say saddle up, attack the British forces. I shoot back, we have resorted to eating our horses. Local merchants deny us equipment, assistance. They only take British money, so sing a song of sixpence. I have never seen the general so despondent. I have taken over writing all his correspondence. Congress writes, George, attack the British forces. I shoot back, we have resorted to eating our horses. Local merchants deny us equipment, assistance. They only take British money, so sing a song of sixpence.
The cavalry's not coming, but sir.
And then what's called the Jefferson Battle number 3, and also called the Slavery Battle, which is an amazing track where, you know, Lynn playing multiple voices is sort of breaking down the entire argument for and against slavery that was made at that time in history.
We cannot cure prejudice or righteous desperate hate. So back to Africa, or do they get a separate state? In 1784, I tried to float, banning slavery in the West. My notion didn't get a single vote. Slavery's a sin, it's growing like a cancer. But we can't address a question if we do not have an answer.
Is it my turn? Good.
Plantation states are packed with promise makers. Do you realize the precious time these legislators wasted? Institutionalizing slavery only multiplies our troubles. Wait till the 1800s and the population doubles. You all know.
There's another one which didn't make this version but may end up being on volume 2. So that, for someone that was a fan of the play, like, to get to hear those outtakes was, you know, that was definitely exciting, and they're awesome.
Yeah, nice. And I wanted to kind of jump back a little bit to you growing up. You know, you're talking about, you know, your dad being a musician, your mom being a fan of music. Your parents are both educators. So what role do you think that kind of played in you becoming this person who makes projects like the Hamilton mixtape that are both entertaining but also, you know, have an educational component?
I mean, obviously, I think it played a huge role. I mean, my mom was also an artist. She was a ceramist, makes pottery. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she teaches is actually, you know, pottery. So I had this sort of arts kind of side and then this educational side. And I mean, every job I ever had before this was teaching. You know, I had some, you know, art and design experience. And when I came to New York, it was actually for a job in that. But, you know, I've always really been, you know, sort of drawn to stories and storytelling. And so for me, you know, what some might call education for me is just storytelling. So if it's the messengers, you know, I'm telling a story. I'm telling four stories. It's, you know, Bob Marley, Fela, Bob Dylan, and Kanan all at once. So, you know, I don't necessarily look at it as educational. I think that, you know, a great story captivates your imagination. And if you can put it to great music, then you're on a whole other level. And that's just been something that has become a hallmark of my, you know, career, because I love it.
Yeah. And, you know, in LA, Greg Mack was a big DJ there growing up. But there was another radio show that I know you liked, the Fly ID show.
Oh, yeah. If all you suckers didn't know, you listen to MC Gon and DJ Rob on the Fly ID show. We got a hype show planned out tonight. Oh, yeah. We got Derelicts and Dialect, the new hype single just out from Third Base. We're about to rock that.
The Fly ID show was broadcast out of Cal State University of Northridge by DJ Rob One. The earliest episodes of the show we could find were from 1990. Rob One passed away in March 2000.
The Fly ID show, which, no, I don't know that anybody remembers the Fly ID show, but where I was, it was like a little kind of local pirate radio station that played, you know, real raw hip hop. I mean, there was K-Day, obviously, but K-Day's signal was actually kind of like inconsistent where I lived. And the Fly ID show, you know, I think it was every Friday night maybe, had all of this New York hip hop. So I was this, you know, kid in LA growing up listening to EPMD and Big Daddy Kane and all of these things, and just that's what made me fall in love with hip hop. Right. So, you know, Fly ID Show, you know, props to that.
But there was this sort of funny thing about growing up in LA, which is you were taking in all this West Coast music that, like you said, didn't maybe grab you as much as the New York stuff. But when you actually moved to New York, knowing all that stuff from virtue of growing up in LA kind of made you stand out, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it was there in the air, whether in LA or in the Bay, you know, where I went to college. And so I got a little bit of both of those worlds, which are, you know, very different musical universes and have incredibly dope music, especially at that time. So, you know, when I came to New York, I found that the Ice Cube tracks, you know, or RBL Posse or Hi-Ro.
Here's why I wanna kill the punk, cause he tried to take a motherfucking chunk of the funk.
There's a bluebird on my shoulder. There's a bluebird on my shoulder. There's a bluebird on my shoulder. Can I kill it? Man, there's a bluebird on my shoulder. Can I kill it? On my shoulder.
Yeah, life is a blast when you know what you're doing, Mr. Know what you're doing for your life get ruined. Life is a thrill when your skill is developed. If you ain't got a skill or trade, then shut the hell up. Life is
that I just knew from, you know, being around, nobody really knew. And they were like, oh my God, what is that? And so that became a signature in my club sets early on, was I would always do a West Coast set and it would blow people's minds because it just didn't happen out here at that point in time. It was still very segregated in that way.
Yeah. And I know you sort of started out as a kid messing around with breakdancing. What was your best move?
My best move, man. What was my best move? I don't know that I had a best move. I mean, I actually had a pretty wicked hand spin. That was like my signature, like pull my sleeve up over my hand and, you know, get that elbow position right. And I did a pretty ill hand spin. But, you know, breakdancing for me wasn't even necessarily straight b-boying. It was just dancing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I was the one like glued to rap videos and learning every dance move and then going out to the club and doing all of the dance moves. So that was my thing. I would say this. I think a lot of my skill as a DJ comes from my years dancing, because, you know, as a dancer, you know how things should flow together to make you keep dancing. And that ebb and flow of energy, I think, is something that a lot of DJs don't really understand if they've never spent any time on a dance floor. So that became a real tool for me when I started DJing.
Yeah, and that kind of gets into something else that I wanted to talk about, which was you didn't even really start DJing at all till you were like 18, 19 years old. It wasn't like you were, you know, 12 years old practicing on turntables in a garage or something. You spent that time dancing and
skateboarding,
to music
and skateboarding and playing basketball.
Yeah. What? How do you think that makes you different than other DJs who maybe kind of were solely focused on DJing from the time they were very young?
Well, I think there's in some ways two kinds of DJs. There's technically sound DJs, and then there's DJs that are selectors. And I think, you know, before I ever, you know, got on turntables, I was a selector. Like, I knew my music really well. Like, I was the kid driving around with the whole CD book on my lap. You know, right. Literally every song I would take out a CD, put in, every song made me want to hear another song. So, you know, I think that was part of it. And when I came to New York, you know, I was discouraged by the fact that people were like technically way better than me. Mm-hmm. And I saw this DJ named Cool Marv, who was like an institution in New York at that time, just tearing it up, juggling and scratching in the club and keeping on the flow. And I was like, geez, like, I'm never gonna be able to do that. Like, I had a couple years of experience on turntables. And then I saw Bobbito. And Bobbito wasn't doing all that. He just was playing amazing music and killing it. Yeah. And that was what made me say, you know what? I can do this. And, you know, and the technical skill has come over time.
Of course.
And I'm still a student of it. You know, I see guys like Jazzy Jeff or Scratch Bastard and what they do. I'm like, fellas, like, you know, show me some stuff. And actually, that's been a really dope, you know, relationship in that way, where my technical ability has now caught up to my musical knowledge. And so it makes a pretty lethal combination, I think.
But at the beginning, when you were DJing in parties in college, it wasn't on turntables, right?
No. My very first party I did was with two CD disc men and a mixer. And the irony of this was that somebody heard me and thought it was so good that they asked me to do this off-campus party. That off-campus party, it turns out, was thrown by the director of all the black fraternity and sororities at Stanford. Right. So everybody was there, and they heard me and would come over and be like, wait, you're doing this with that? And so I had this whole career at Stanford DJing all of these Alpha and Kappa Delta parties where I was using that. I wasn't using turntables. But again, I knew my music so well, I could kill it
right
like that. So, you know, the rest came later.
Right. Amazing. And so, you know, college, you know, it's sort of interesting given where you ended up, your experience at Stanford. Like, you started out studying African American studies and Jewish studies, right?
Yep.
But there was something kind of missing in that, and you ended up changing. What weren't you getting out of that kind of dual focus?
I mean, I think obviously, you know, there's a multiplicity of you know, cultures in the world that are interesting, and you know, my fascination with hip hop maybe had you know, developed a fascination with African American culture in different ways, but you know, and my background is, you know, being Jewish. But, you know, I thought that there was more to it than that. So I ended up doing something called the individually designed major, where I had to basically come up with a bunch of classes, create a curriculum, go before a committee and defend my curriculum, you know, for that to become a major. And I did that. And it ended up being a major called Identity, Mind, and Multiculturalism. So it was like cultural psychology and sociology and anthropology and all these things. And it just was more, you know, wide ranging and diverse, I guess. And so were my interests. Right. So, you know, that's kind of how it ended up there. I mean, who knows what the practical application of that was, except maybe kind of what I'm doing now.
I was going to say, it plays pretty directly into your life and interests now in this weird way.
Yeah. And that's been the irony of, you know, my major that I had no idea how it would be applied in the real world.
Right.
And I've kind of, you know, circled back around to it now. And I mean, that's a good feeling, like to kind of come full circle in that way, to where this sort of, you know, left path that I took of, you know, studying that, and then this other left path I took of DJing have somehow met, you know, and coalesced in this way. So it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. There was a story from your childhood that I heard you tell that I wanted to delve into for a second that kind of gets into some of these ideas of race. Maybe you can tell us to do with Prince and the BET Award.
Wow. Yeah, this, you know, I often cite this as a key moment in my understanding of race and the world, because, you know, my obsession, my first musical obsession was Prince. I wanted to be Prince. And, you know, as a kid who was maybe, you know, 9 or 10 years old, you know, before you really have a real understanding of, you know, race and those kinds of things, or I want to say maybe I was in third grade when this happened. Mm-hmm. Might have been younger, because my sister was 5 years older and she was still at the elementary school, probably in sixth grade, regardless. So, the story basically was that, you know, I was obsessed with Prince, and I overheard my sister and some of her friends talking about how Prince was going to play in the BET Awards. And I said, "What's that?" And they said, "You know, Black Entertainment Television." And I was like, "Well, why is Prince going to play on that?" And they kind of looked at me like, "What do you mean?" And they were like, "Because he's black." And my immediate instinctive response was, "No, he's not. He looks like me." Because I had this poster on my wall, and Prince's skin color looked, you know, very similar to my skin color. And I didn't understand the construct of race. Like, it just was like, oh, he looks like me. I want to be him. I can grow up to become like him. And so it was this, like, lack of understanding of why those two things didn't line up, like his actual skin color with his, you know, sort of racial, quote-unquote, experience, that in some ways created a foundation for me in not understanding. And I put, you know, understanding in quotes, just because obviously I understand the dynamics, but I think it's a refusal to accept them as given that has been the basis for a lot of my experience, like not thinking that I can't go to a certain place or do a certain thing because of the way I look, whether it's different from the rest of the room or whether, you know, I'm with someone who looks different from the rest of the room. Like, those types of things to me just never stopped me in that way. And so, like, I point back to that moment of, like, not understanding as the foundation for my, you know, refusal, I guess, to accept and understand that in the rest of my life.
Yeah. And something that kind of built off of that was this idea that, you know, you look somewhat ethnically ambiguous and you would often, depending on, I think, as a kid, where you were and who you were with, people would read you differently.
Yeah, and that was true. Like, if I would be with a group of my, you know, black friends in a convenience store, I would have the very curious experience of being followed around, you know, and it started to help me understand that experience. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was, depending on my facial hair when I got older, like, I was thought to be, you know, half black or Arab or, you know, this or that. And all of those things for me just ended up being a window into the way people, you know, perceive things. And it's just taught me a lot, basically. It's helped me become, you know, empathetic, I guess, to other people's experiences.
I can imagine. So, you know, you go to New York and, you know, you're starting to DJ and all this stuff. Was there a specific turning point for you where you said to yourself, "Hey, I'm a DJ"?
I mean, I had a day job, you know, for the first 3 years doing graphic design when I was here. And the moment that that ended, where that company went out of business, I was invited by a group called Design I, who I'd become friends with, mm-hmm. to go to Brazil for a show they were doing. And I, you know, I'd just been laid off and I was, you know, looking for something to do. I'd been DJing more as a hobby on the weekends. And I went down there and, you know, the show that they played that I DJed was literally a floating stage on a lake with the audience on the sand. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment where I was, you know, DJing and I was just like, I think I could do this. And it, you know, that was definitely a key moment. Mm. But, you know, it's been a sort of a crazy road. You know, you never know where this thing is going to lead. And, you know, I remember having conversations when I was in my 20s with friends of my parents, or they were like, all right, well, you know, at least figure it out by the time you're 30. And then I was 30 and I still hadn't totally figured it out, but I felt like in my gut that I was going in the right direction. So, you know, I think there have been plenty of those milestones. You know, I think, you know, getting something in the Source, you know, which for a hip hop kid is, you know, amazing, was a big moment.
Jay was voted the Source's Mixtape DJ of the Year in 2005.
I think meeting, you know, Pasta Noose and going to give him my Big Daddy Kane CD, and he's like, oh, I already have that. I love it. You know, that, like, things like that were big moments. But, you know, there really wasn't like a single moment where I felt like I'm doing it. I mean, maybe on Friday when the Hamilton mixtape comes out, I'll be like, yo, I'm really doing it.
Yeah, you add a little postscript.
Hello, and welcome to our very special Ham for Ham. I'm Questlove, and I'm Black Thought of the Roots, the legendary Roots crew. We're excited to give you guys the Hamilton mixtape tonight, and we got a lot more awesome performances coming up for you here. But before we even get started, I want you guys to give it up for our DJs, DJ Illmind and Jay Period. Yeah.
I wanted to go into just one or two of the mixtapes specifically, you know, because they're sort of so intricate. I was listening to the James Brown one, the history one, not the live one. And there's just kind of so much there, right? There's the, you know, there's his music, but then also sort of what the songs signify and the samples and, you know, the mashups and the influence on Michael Jackson and all of this kind of stuff.
What I'm going to say is brief, but to the point. James Brown is my greatest inspiration. All right. Ever since I was a small child. And when I saw him move, I was mesmerized. And right then and there, I knew that that was exactly what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
How did you take such a, like, a towering figure like James Brown, who has like half a century of stuff, and turn it into one project?
That is an excellent question. And the crazy part is I think I did that in about 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe.
I don't even know how you got through all the interview footage, never mind the music, in 2.5 weeks.
True. I mean, look, you know, my process is really one of complete immersion. Like, I really, that's all I listen to for that period of time. I surround myself with it. I mean, it's almost like laying out all the puzzle pieces on the ground and just continuing to sit there until you start to feel like these things can go together, and you just draw connections. It's all about kind of drawing those connections, and then eventually those connections build up into bigger connections. You know, the hardest part of that mixtape, I mean, there's a lot of things that are difficult about making that because it really was overwhelming, but the hardest part of that was sort of distilling down all of the hip-hop samples into like one seamless flow where all the layers are referring to things.
With the dawn of rap came the era of sampling, a recording technique where parts of an existing record are mixed into a new song. Brown suddenly became featured in songs he hadn't recorded or even heard.
Here I am, R-A-W, a terrorist. Second to none, making MCs fun, so don't try to step through me, because I ain't the one.
And this is something that hip-hop taught me, is like that referential, you know, kind of idea, and then making it flow all together as one thing that you can dance to.
Right.
So, you know, there's a part of it that is literally just like blacking out and just going there. And then there's a part of it that's trying to be kind of like organized about how I lay these puzzle pieces out so that I just start to catch vibes off of things. And, you know, there's a weird kind of, you know, in the stars sort of component to every one of these mixtapes, because after I'm done with them, I sometimes don't understand how I did them.
Right.
Like Lauryn Hill, don't understand. Mary, you know, like, yeah. These are big stories. And so there's a part of it that's that. And, you know, I think that's the beauty of it. It's like, that's like where I feel like I'm not a musician playing keys, but I'm channeling something and, you know, that's bigger than me, basically.
Right. And yeah, I mean, with James, it's like you could have done a tape just on the clap your hands, stomp your feet break.
Clap your hands, stomp your feet. Clap your hands, stomp your feet.
Or a tape just on the funky drummer break.
One, two, three, four, get it.
How you had to distill all of that down to...
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is, I really always want to approach it in a different way than someone else is going to. Like, there's certain mixtapes I haven't done because I don't know what that approach... Like, I haven't done a J mixtape because my J mixtape needs to be, like, a completely different approach than anyone else's, and I don't know what that approach is yet, so maybe it'll come to me at some point. But, you know, this one, you know, same thing with the Q-Tip mixtape. It's like, you can't just make a Tribe mixtape. Like, I gotta go and get people to remake the Tribe song, you know?
Hey, yo, J Period want you to understand.
Your fantasy back in the days was to be native.
Word up. This is the daylight version of Excursions. Check it out. Back in the day when I was a teenager, when we signed a Tommy Boy instead of the major, you can find Workmatic listening to hip hop, trying to add the right ingredients so not the flip flops.
Can't just make, you know, a James Brown mixtape. Like, you really have to approach it in a different way. And that is to not overlook the things that are overlooked: his cultural significance, his influence on the musicians that we know and love from our childhood, and then the way that he planted, like, the seed for hip hop. Like, you know, so much is there, and it's like you don't really get it until you hear it all together. Then you're like, holy shit, like, look at everything he influenced. So
speaking of the Q-Tip tape, that was equally involved and intricate, maybe more so in some ways, probably the most ambitious project you've done. Can you talk about, you know, A, why the scope of that was so large, and B, kind of how you made it come together?
Man, I mean, Tribe is my favorite group of all time. You know,
I should know, for people who can't see, he's literally wearing a Tribe sweatshirt now.
I am indeed. I represent. So, you know, that one, I think, was something I always dreamed of making. Mm-hmm. And I ran into Q-Tip in like 07. And he was like, I love that Lauryn Hill mixtape you did. And I just kind of made note of that. And when I heard that he was starting to work on a new album, I spoke to him about doing a tape for him. And he was with it. And, you know, part of it was with Tip, you know, there's an elusive, mysterious component there. And, you know, he agreed to grant me a 15-minute interview. That 15-minute interview, based on the questions I asked, went for 2.5 hours. And so, you know, the volume and breadth of that, of the scope of that, became the seed for why this had to be like it was. And, you know, it's partially telling the complicated story of the balancing act between Q-Tip as a solo artist and Tribe, which then, you know, now we all can look around and imagine, you know, Tribe back together because they just put out the new album. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, it was not really a thought. And so there was that balancing act. And it was also, you know, again, like with the James or any of these other ones, just doing it justice. You know, you're going to do a Tribe mixtape, you better do it justice or stay home. Right. And the only way I thought that you could do that was to get other artists to pay tribute to Tribe. And fortunately, by then, I'd done the Nas, the Kane, the Lauryn Hill, and, you know, had a little bit of traction, primarily with artists. You know, like, a lot of people out in the world still don't know J Period, but artists really, you know, responded to what I did. So when I asked De La or Consequence...
Kanye West with J Period... Elements in the building.
Set
it off.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? Cons took a check from every boss in the business, and you can't be mad at me. Thanks for having me. I'm from the same devil as Maldives. The tragedy might be on Chelsea.
You know, or, you know, the Roots or anybody to contribute, everybody was like, done. And they did. And I think even they felt a little bit of this is for Q-Tip, we've got to show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, that became, you know, really and truly the seeds for that mixtape. And a lot of people don't know there's actually a volume 2 to that mixtape, which I've been sitting on for quite some time at Q-Tip's request. And, you know, hopefully the world will get to hear it very soon, because there's, you know, Black Thought doing, you know, Tribe Song, Pharoah Monch, you know, Common. Like, there's a lot of good stuff on Volume 2 as well.
Wow. And Lauryn Hill, you know, she sort of has a reputation as a bit of a reclusive figure, but you've worked with her extensively. You got her involved in her Greatest Hits tape. You performed with her. How did that relationship begin?
You know, that's another one where I loved Lauryn Hill, as many people, you know, do and did. And I really thought there would be something powerful about putting all of her work in one place. And so I wanted to start that independent of knowing her. And then I was fortunate enough early in the stages of that to meet Rohan Marley, who became a fan of my mixtapes. And then we became friends. Yeah.
Rohan Marley is the son of Bob Marley and Jadon Hunt and played college football at Miami with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and NFL superstars Warren Sapp and Ray Lewis. Marley met Lauryn Hill, with whom he has five children, in 1996. While they never officially married, Hill referred to him as her husband throughout their relationship, which ended in 2009.
So, I mean, he literally, like, I gave him a couple tapes, and he moves out to L.A., and he hits me 2 weeks later. He's like, J-Period, I need some more tapes. Send him more. 2 weeks later, more. You know, like, and this happened for, like, a couple months. So he and I ended up becoming friends, and when I told him about what I wanted to do, he was like, that's got nothing to do with me. You know, here's her email. You can hit her up directly. And, you know, I sat for, you know, hours upon hours crafting this email.
Perfect email, sure.
To which the response came, no, thank you, not interested. And, you know, and then I sat for days with that before I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway. And I wrote back respectfully saying that I was going to do this anyway. And I just started working on it. And I worked on it for the better part of a year until another relationship I had with the Deaf Poetry kind of group led back to Lauryn Hill, when she kind of had this return to the spotlight, you know, on Deaf Poetry.
Typical Hollywood follies, good girl, while vice and corruption take over the world. Motives and thoughts. Check your motives and thoughts. Line with the wickedness deep in your heart. Modern day wickedness is all you've been taught. Lie to your neighbors so you get ahead. Modern day trickery is all you've been fed. Motives and thoughts. Check your motives and thoughts. Thank you.
I was there physically, and I told her before, you know, early that morning I was going to go to the show. I wanted a drop for the mixtape. And, you know, after the show, she gave me the holy grail of drops.
Right.
This is Lauryn Hill.
This is Lauryn Hill. This is Lauryn Hill.
This is J-Period.
J-Period.
J-Period. This is the best of Lauryn Hill.
And, you know, co-signed the mixtape. And I don't even think she fully understood, you know, what I was doing. And, you know, the irony of that whole situation was that I don't think she knew what to make of me. You know, she saw me, maybe she judged me by my appearance, you know, what have you. 2 or 3 days later, I got an email from her kind of going off on me for, you know, the fact that I was not doing this from a genuine place. And, you know, I was trying to take advantage of her and all of this stuff, and you know, asking me to call her Miss Hill. And, you know, I kind of sat with that also for a minute, because it was basically like she sent me one email, then another, like 3 hours later, then went to bed that night, woke up the next morning, and sent me another email. And the third email was kind of apologizing for the first two and saying, but I still would be preferred to, you know, be called Miss Hill. And I sat with that for a long time, and I just thought about it, and I thought, you know, this is a complicated person. This is a very thoughtful person, and, you know, and I respect all of those things. However, there's nobody on earth who can tell me I'm not doing this for the right reasons. So, you know, when I wrote back, I sort of said, you know, I respect the fact that you want to be called Miss Hill. Rohan had, you know, spoken to you as Lauryn. So that's what when I wrote you, that's what I said. I will call you Miss Hill, no sweat. But secondly, there's no one on earth who has the right to tell me that I'm not doing this for the right reasons. And I kind of went off on her back. And the craziest thing happened. Within 5 minutes of sending that email, I got a response from her that said, now I can see who you are, and now we can talk. And that was sort of like I broke through the wall by being myself and defending myself. And so, you know, that turned into this crazy conversation over months of us going back and forth on email while I'm working on this mixtape. I end up finishing it. It comes out, you know, it does what it does. And I had done a couple things. You know, I'd sent her a copy and didn't hear back. I had gotten the fold-out art that Fuse Green had done, framed for Fuse, myself, Rohan, and Miss Hill. And I brought it and kind of, you know, presented it to her at a show that I was asked to go do with her. And, you know, essentially what happened is I ran into her brother somewhere. When I was introduced to him, he said, "Oh my God, it's so great to meet you. My sister has had your CD in the kitchen CD player for 6 months and she won't take it out." And I was like, like, you know, like what?
Yeah.
And it was sort of like that, like, shoot me now, like, you know, kind of moment.
Yeah.
And that was one of those things that let me know that this had really kind of penetrated not just the ether, but, you know, her ether.
Yeah.
And from there, I got asked to go out as her tour DJ, you know, which was a short lived thing, but it was still an incredible experience of being like Lauryn Hill coming to my apartment in Fort Greene and staying there for 6 hours, and we just talked. And so I got to know her on a personal level, and it's part of why I don't buy any of this stuff with people talking about she's crazy. She's not crazy. She's very smart. You know, like, what happens is that when you get that level of attention, and, you know, sometimes you have to put up a wall. Mm-hmm. And her wall is a firm wall, and not that many people get through it. And, you know, I'm definitely blessed and fortunate that I, you know, was able to.
Yeah. One other project I wanted to dig into for a minute is you've done a lot of stuff with Pete Rock and CL Smooth. Like, you got them together for a live show. You got them together for a song, you know, it seems like. And then, you know, you did a separate tape with CL. But it seems like that particular group, you kind of have a thing about, you know, forcing them back together.
I mean, you know, really what it is that Mecca and the Soul Brother was one of my anthems. When I design the army, I can reign, but never have more beef than Saddam Hussein. The nightcap, so prepare for a gas scan when I turn your brain into Mugugu pan. Finger licking the papes like there is no other. Mecca and the Soul Brother. Mecca and the Soul Brother. Like, that was one of my albums, like, I knew backwards and forwards. And Pete Rock and CL belong together. And I'm so glad that now, you know, they are back together,
right, performing
doing shows
together and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I won't name specifics, but I will just say that in getting to know the inner dynamics of a lot of my favorite groups, mm-hmm. you know, you come to understand that they are complicated because they're all relationships between people. And, you know, and those tend to be complicated.
Yeah.
So, you know, Pete and CL, Tribe, I look at all of these as a whole entity in my heart, in my mind. And I imagine Pete and CL doing stuff together. So when I had the opportunity to do the mixtape for John Legend, and CL had already done a verse, and it was a song the Roots, you know, made sampling the idea of Pete Rock. As long as there's a you, there's a better me, is why we're together and stronger than they ever thought it could be. A world motherless can help care cover this, a love for all people, no matter what the culture is. I was like, well, there's only one thing to do here, go get Pete Rock.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I went and I did that. So Questlove hit me, enough respect to Pete Rock, I just hit you with a jewel for real. And then, you know, with the show at Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival, again, it's like, you know, you want to do it right, whether it's the mixtape or the show or whatever, do it the right way. And in that way, you got to get them back together again.
I'm standing, I'm doing it, and my mind is blown. So I can only imagine what the fans feel. Here we go. I'm ripping this for a spell, or shall I say big fat? 22 years ago to keep it on track. The birth of a child on the 8th of October. A toast
when my granddaddy came sober. So, you know, that's another, you know, for the only the heads really appreciate that one to the full extent. But, like, that's a real notch on the belt right there to have done that.
Definitely. And, you know, you obviously work a lot with Black Thought. What is kind of your relationship like with him?
Man, I mean, at this point, I would probably say he's one of my, you know, closest friends in hip hop. And it's sort of crazy to say that on some level, but it's true. I mean, I think that with, you know, Thought, there is a bar of entry,
mm-hmm.
and you have to meet that bar of entry not once, but every time. And, you know, as you continue to meet that, you know, he opens up. And again, there, you know, there's a veneer that being in the public eye forces you to have. And, you know, behind that, incredibly thoughtful, smart, funny, good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I just, you know, like, we see eye to eye on a lot of things, and he's got a great sense of humor. And, you know, I definitely like to crack some jokes. It's been a really awesome relationship, both in terms of trying to help perpetually remind people what an incredible MC he is.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, and do my part to put out product that shows that. And also just kind of, you know, getting to know him as a person, like, has been incredible. So, yeah.
When you're doing the live mixtape stuff with him, how much is kind of improvised and how much is planned? Because you'll do these, you know, 25, 30, 40 minute continuous sets where you're switching up beats and he's sort of freestyling over, you know, or rhyming over everything and switching topics sort of depending on the beat and all that.
I said, yo, I try to get it how I live it. A lot of people counting on me kind of like a digit. It's a cold world, I ain't fronting like it isn't. It's no time for coming up shorter than a midget. Y'all know I'ma raise the bar though, like Bridget. See there a star, go, don't blink, you might miss it. It's precious cargo, you gotta be strong and lift it. The light comes in different types, be more specific. Look, I'm...
How much is sketched out before you step on stage?
I mean, I think there's definitely a sketch. He knows what beats I'm gonna drop, and he's given some thought to, you know, what verses might go over it. But, you know, whether with Black Thought or The Roots, there is a healthy, healthy dose of pure improvisation. You know, I often say that when you're playing with The Roots, which I've done as a DJ, you know, many times now, you prepare the set list and you prepare to get on stage and abandon the set list, you know, and there are audibles called, you know, in the moment all the time. You know, with Tariq, you know, and some of it's by virtue of Serato, which helps me to do this, I can set markers for various points, you know, where a verse starts or a chorus starts or, you know, different things so that I can watch him and follow his lead. And with him on stage, that's the name of the game. Like, you have to follow his lead. So I can give myself a framework, but when we get on stage, I never know how it's going to go, which is part of why it's awesome for both of us. Like, I think that's why he appreciates doing these sets, is like, it's a different energy than him being with The Roots, you know? So
how did you kind of first start working with him?
You know, I did the Best of The Roots in 06, mm-hmm. and that was for Def Jam and for the label, for the Game Theory album. And, you know, the first experience I had was sort of getting him in the studio to record some of those tracks. And he like literally hadn't slept in 2 weeks. So he's exhausted and he's like mustering the last bit of his energy. And, you know, Amir was really impressed with how I managed to take that performance and extract the best of it and make it really sound good.
This is the official, Best of The Roots. Def Jam Records. Let's go. Son of a Tommy Gunner, Black Islamic number runner, shooting up the movie with the Uzi in it, play a ton of villain. You rooting for when Roots group perform. I'm like the battering ram and smash through your door. Here come the Black Star.
That began my relationship, but then it was Brooklyn Hip Hop Festival. I would do these, you know, the original version of the live mixtape was literally like you would do a mixtape live on stage, but I'd have the artists sort of hiding backstage and come out and surprise, you know, Jeru is going to perform or OC or Brand Nubian or whatever. So 1 year, they had me in a more of a kind of headlining kind of role. And I said, you know, well, let's see if Black Thought wants to do it. And it turns out that he was available and he came out. He did like 3 or 4 songs.
Yo, here I'm a start of that. Look, I'm a part of that. Downtown Philly, where it's realer than a heart attack. It wasn't really that ill until it started crack. That was the body called every night on the almanac.
And it went so well that when I got an offer for us to go do this in Toronto at the Manifesto, he was with it. And, you know, for that one, I mean, it was incredible. They had like 16 cameras, you know, shooting all angles. And, you know, we recorded Pro Tools out of the board. And that became the first version of the live mixtapes.
Welcome to T-Dot. Yes, this a message to retrack. Soundboy killing your beatbox. My lyrical heat cock. Jay Perry, it got the streets locked. My mellow got pull like a slingshot. Welcome to T-Dot.
You know, I think it was, again, me showing and proving, like, here's what it could be. And then me making it to a mixtape and putting that out was another side of it. And, you know, it just grew from there.
How is working with him now that he kind of has a day job as a TV star? How is that? Has that changed anything?
I mean, it definitely makes him easier to find. You know, like they're right. They're up there every day. So I'm at Fallon quite often just to catch them. But I mean, look, it's great. I think when you have somebody like him who's, you know, sort of perpetually underrated, you know, either by virtue of him being in a band, you know, where you know, Questlove maybe is the sort of more known quantity and bigger personality. It's awesome for him to have a platform for people to get to know him on you know, and he's also a multi-talented guy. Like, he's, you know, he's acting now and he can sing and, you know, he raps. So it's like, I love it. You know, I love the fact that Fallon exists and it's a great platform for them.
Yeah. And your stuff with the Nets, you co-wrote their theme song with John Forte.
Life is more than just a dream when your team's strong. We write anthems, this is more than just a theme song.
develop stuff to be used in their games, music pieces to be used in their games. When you were creating the music pieces to be used in the games, what are some of the variables you had to think about that people might not be aware of?
Well, I think with the Nets, I tried to really create a soundtrack. And obviously, you know, I'm somebody that loves and knows basketball really well. So I thought about a different kind of approach to how you could score a basketball game. And it's not just like, you know, three DJ breaks in the course of the game. It's like, okay, what's playing in this moment of the game and this and all these different scenarios. So number one was to break down all those scenarios in a game, you know, or when we're on offense and defense, when, you know, fourth quarter, when it's like super high intensity, when there's a jump ball, you know, like all these things, and then just flip them. So, you know, instead of House of Pain, jump around, let me mix up, you know, James Brown, get up, get on up. And then make that the thing that plays. So it's just like a different approach to these same things. And then, you know, beyond that, the variables were, you know, what does Brooklyn consist of? It's all races. It's all ethnicities. It's all ages. You know, like at a basketball game, it's all of these different things. So you've got to create a really, you know, diverse palette of sound. You've got to sprinkle in some Jay-Z and Biggie, you know, to make it authentic. And then, you know, you have to kind of do that thing, which is like what I call, you know, wedding DJing, where, you know, and not do that. I'm saying you have to not do the wedding DJ thing, which is like play, you know, the obvious records. You got to take the obvious records, set them aside, and then find the other records that accomplish the same goal so that it feels different and new. And I think the combination of all those things made it so that, you know, the music was very specific to Brooklyn. It felt Brooklyn. There was raw hip hop. There was, you know, dance music, all of these things. And, you know, taking into account all of those different variables is what made it what it is. And you know, everybody loved it. So clearly it worked.
A couple things about that. First off, some of those pieces are as short as 9 or 10 seconds long. How do you think about like the structure of a piece when you have literally 10 seconds? Do you think like intro, beginning, you know, middle, end? How does that work?
Well, I think like some of the sound effects are that short and those get sprinkled in throughout the game. So the other thing I had to do is kind of like sit with the guy who pushes the buttons and, you know, talk to him about how I would approach it. And he already had his approach. So it was kind of balancing those. But I restructured a lot of the records. You know, if you have the best part of the record is the chorus, and you've got, you know, normally 40 seconds before you get there, then I'm going to remake that track to have like a 4, you know, beat lead in, and it goes right into the chorus. So you know that if you've got a 30 second timeout, that's still going to have time to hit with full impact and then, you know, segue out. So again, it's like, it's sort of the mixtape approach that I use. It's, you know, the DJ approach that I use. It's just knowing what's appropriate and trying to make the pieces, you know, fit together.
How do you balance stuff? Like, how do you mix for an arena? Mm. Like, I assume you didn't have unlimited access to Barclays to like mix, right?
Well, I will say this, man, best sound check experience of all time. They would let me into Barclays to sound check all of them. And then I would often work with an engineer that was familiar with arenas, and, you know, he would kind of help maneuver things a little bit sonically if I'm adding an 808 or something to give it more, you know, oomph. But yeah, I mean, you get in there, you test it out, and then you are aware that when the whole place is full, it's going to sound different as well. And so there was trial and error the first 2 months that I did that, of tweaking and changing things and seeing what worked and what didn't. But again, it's like anything else. You're reading the crowd, you're seeing what they respond to, you're seeing like the impact of a particular track, and then some of those become staples. Like, I made an intro that I think they still use, which is sort of Jay-Z vocals, you know, Welcome to Brooklyn, birthplace of Michael Jordan, home of Biggie Smalls.
From the Welcome to New York record.
Welcome to the Empire State, home of the World Trade. Birthplace of Michael Jordan, home of Biggie Smalls.
And re-edited that to make it appropriate for that moment, and then put it over a couple different beats and let them, you know, do this one on one night and this on another night. Or, you know, after halftime, when you're coming back in and you need energy, you know, there was one signature one that they would use, which was like Fat Joe, you know, My Lifestyle mixed in with little, you know, Brooklyn, you know, kind of signature things. So, yeah, I mean, it was kind of customizing and tailor making all these things for all those situations.
Can you talk a bit about your relationship with Spike Lee? You've done a bunch of stuff with him. I guess the first thing that I can think of was the Michael Jackson tape.
People that much talent, they're not going to be normal. But for me, I'm not even dealing with that. I'm celebrating his legacy, which is music.
How did you meet him? How did the Michael Jackson tape come about?
I mean, I originally met Spike through Fuse Green, the artist who had done the Michael Jackson posters for him. Mm-hmm. And I had done a mixtape, you know, when Michael passed away. I mean, the first version, I literally stayed up all night and did the night he passed away. And then I adapted it over the course of the next year. And the initial, you know, introduction to Spike was me just basically offering to, you know, give out a bunch of mixtapes. And he liked the mixtape so much that he asked me to come back and do that again the following year. And then, you know, like when you're kind of in Spike's rotation, you just get random calls at random times to do things. And he's called me to do all kinds of things, like to be in his pilot for HBO that, you know, unfortunately didn't get picked up.
This was a 2012 boxing drama based on the life of Mike Tyson called The Brick, which was supposed to have starred John Boyega, now famous for his leading role in Star Wars: The Force Awakens.
You know, you get a call the morning that Prince passes away to go to 40 Acres that night and play a block party, you know, which is then, you know, shown across the entire, yeah, you know, universe.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think with Spike, again, it's like, you know, you just always, you know, kind of, it's not that you're expecting it, because you're never expecting it, but those calls come, and when they do, you know, you do it, you know. And there's only been one occasion where Spike called me for something major and I couldn't do it, and that was the Mike Tyson Broadway mm-hmm. play. He wanted me to DJ in the theater, but I had to be in Australia for the whole run of the show, and I couldn't cancel the tour. So, you know, it ended up going, I think, Clark Kent, I mean, who's, you know,
sure,
the, you know, God's favorite DJ.
Right.
You can find out more about Clark Kent on Cypher episode 139 with Torre, but you should know that he's got his hands in just about everything and everyone, including discovering and introducing Jay-Z and Biggie.
So, you know, so it's all good, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I love the fact that I'll get a random call from Spike Lee and find myself, you know, in 6 hours playing a block party in Fort Greene for
right.
thousands
so,
of people.
So speaking of that, obviously, that was, I think that was the last time I saw you perform.
Yeah.
Spike Lee is hosting a block party tonight and telling Prince fans to wear something purple in his memory.
Can you take me through that day from getting the call to, like, getting up on stage? What was it like?
Well, I think you have to flash back to my, you know, sort of earliest musical, you know, moments to really understand how deep that was for me. And, I mean, when Michael passed, I was asked by DigiWax, which is a music service, to put together a playlist just so they could send to DJs. And that was me starting to pull tracks, became me making this entire mixtape. With Prince, I was frozen. I mean, I was literally, like, dumbfounded, frozen by the news. And I was standing in front of CNN at 10 a.m. when that phone rang and it was Spike. And that was kind of my call to action. It was like, okay, like, enough mourning, now go start getting ready. And so I just sat with the music all day long. And you know, there were some things even in my, you know, own kind of knowledge of his catalog that I missed even that night, and I didn't play, and that I kicked myself, you know, afterwards for. Yeah. But, you know, it was really overwhelming. And in some ways, like, I wasn't really playing that for everybody out there. Like, I was really playing that for me. And so, you know, I don't know that there's a recording of it, but I was just, you know, kind of going through my memories of Prince, and it was my catharsis, you know, basically. And then the moment where, you know, I get to play Purple Rain and loop it up, you know, then that's like my gift to everyone else. It's like, okay, now everyone, let's just soak in this moment and, you know, and let it out. And from what I heard from people that were out in the crowd, like, I mean, people were, like, weeping. And that's what I think all of us needed, you know, was that. You know, I don't know that I shed a tear necessarily, but I definitely felt that feeling in my chest.
Yeah. You know, I think I asked you this at the time, like, how much of your set was planned?
Zero.
So you knew, let's go crazy at the beginning. Perfect. Purple Rain at the end.
Anybody that knows what's up would have said that.
Sure.
And I do think Spike came in and asked for that as well, but that was already the plan. Like, it has Makes to sense, begin right. with Dearly Beloved, we are gathered here today.
Right.
And then it has to end on Purple Rain. And, you know, the crazy experience I've had since is that I don't know. Really, there's still a question in my mind. You talk about tackling a catalog like James Brown. There's a question in my mind about whether I have the wherewithal to really do this. But I have already started gathering what amounts to probably the most comprehensive collection of prints the world has ever seen.
I can vouch for this. I've seen a tiny, tiny, tiny smidgen of this, and it's mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing, and it's so mind-blowing that I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around it in some ways. Like, I want to do a Prince tribute, you know? Like, I have thought about ways to do it that are respectful of Prince, and, you know, and also a gift to his fans. But really, it's the kind of thing that, like, I need to make for myself. And I always imagine making a Prince mixtape, but it's so foreboding that I pushed it, you know, back and back. And then when this happened, I was like, okay, let me do the in-gathering, and then we're just going to sit and see when the feeling strikes.
Right. But the in-gathering is, you know, 30 days worth of music or whatever it is.
It's insane. Yeah. I mean, it's like I rated the foremost Prince authorities record collections, and they gave me everything. And then, you know, I just have to sift through it. And for any of you that see me on the street, I do not carry this around with me.
Yes, exactly. So, exactly.
It's like I'm setting myself up right there.
Right. So I hear that there is an actual album.
There is.
In progress. What's going on with that?
Man, you know, this has been something I've been working on for the better part of 2 years. You know, probably because I'm a crazy perfectionist, and also probably because I keep being exposed to more and more talented people that change my thinking about what I want to do. So as of right now, we're looking to have something out by spring. I mean, I probably have 75 tracks. It will probably be whittled down on the first version of it to maybe like 5 to 7, just bangers. And, I mean, it's going to feature a lot of the artists that are, you know, on the mixtapes that you've sort of become familiar with, working with me, and then, some other really talented, you know, artists you might not have heard of. And you know, in that I have, to give a lot of thanks to Jazzy Jeff and the Playlist Retreat.
The Playlist Retreat is an annual gathering put on by DJ Jazzy Jeff. It is, according to his website, an intimate gathering of progressive artists for the purpose of inspiration, motivation, and collaboration. It is an organic exchange between people who believe in the greater purpose of expression through music.
Which has sort of introduced me to an incredible roster of not just incredibly talented, but incredibly good guys that have become, you know, close friends and also collaborators. So now when I go into the studio, it's not just me there. It's, you know, me calling everyone from that group to the studio, and we just jam. And then I take from those jam sessions and you know, make tracks. So, I mean, it's crazy. You know, like, I've got guys like Stro Elliott and 14KT and Masego, you know, contributing. And, you know, obviously Black Thought is going to be on there. You know, not as many people know about the relationship I have with Joss Stone, but Joss Stone is going to be on there.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Joss,
she,
actually,
she worked with Questlove way back, right, on her first, her first solo stuff.
Sometimes these feelings can be so misleading. Questlove played drums on and produced several songs on singer Joss Stone's 2003 debut album, The Soul Sessions, including Sean's personal favorite, the White Stripes cover, Fell in Love with a Boy.
So I actually did a mixtape for that album, which got caught up in red tape at Epic and never came out. But that began my relationship with Joss Stone. And I mean, it's kind of funny, but it might be like a Mary J. Blige situation where, like, she's singing background on, like, you know, five of the tracks, because I got her over so many different things, and her voice is just spectacular.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's some of those artists. And then, you know, there's a lot that I don't want to say specifically, you know, leave some to the surprise factor. But, I mean, you know, it's my sort of attempt to tell my story in a way through my music. And I've been telling all these other people's stories this whole time. So it's not like I'm going to tell my actual story, but I think the story of all of my, you know, musical influences and or the story of, you know, what I think music can do in the world.
And, you know, speaking of what stuff can do in the world, you have a lot of, you know, you're thinking a lot about, you know, racial and economic justice and kind of its relationship to the arts, right? And maybe kind of getting some people together.
Yeah. So, I mean, I produced the, well, composed and produced this, the main theme for a show called America Divided, which came out recently on Epix and is going to be on Hulu. Produced by Common, Jesse Williams, Shonda Rhimes, Norman Lear. It's really an incredible show.
By the way, that's an insane list of people
right?
to have produced a show.
Yeah. And then features, you know, guest correspondents, Amy Poehler, Zach Galifianakis, Rosario Dawson, a few others I can't remember off top. But basically, that show and that work has led me to all kinds of interesting things, among them, you know, performing at the launch of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History, conducting kind of panel discussions at the Playlist Retreat, actually, at the Smithsonian about arts and activism. And then now has led to a partnership with Young Guru on a project which we are putting together that's going to be, you know, a nonprofit that is trying to put, you know, the music that we want to see out into the world. And you know, between his connections and mine, I think that we have the ability to do that. And then proceeds would fund arts education programs and to helping create and foster the next generation of artists, you know, sort of responding to the world. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to look at the world and if you're an artist, not respond to what you see. And I think, you know, I've been saying a lot lately that the time for, you know, mumble rap is over. And that doesn't mean that every song needs to be political, but it means there needs to be a place for that, you know, in the, you know, group of songs that are played on that level. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And I am happy and, you know, honored to contribute to that in whatever way I can.
Amazing. And so what was the African American History Museum opening like?
Man, overwhelming. You know, I put together a live mixtape. The original was going to be me and Black Thought, and then the Roots got booked to go to Chicago. So I, you know, kind of rethought what I wanted to do, and I thought that it would be, you know, appropriate to sort of tell almost the musical history of the African American experience by remixing everything. So I put together a show that was sampling Fela and Coltrane and, you know, Marvin Gaye and James Brown, Isaac Hayes, all the way up to Public Enemy and hip hop, and then, you know, gathered a collection of voices that I think really had something to say. So I had Drez from Black Sheep come and perform Black with Envy. I had Pharoah Monch come and perform The Truth, M1 come and perform spoken word poet Maida Del Valle, Rhymefest, who actually spits over the theme song I did for America Divided. And, you know, we put together a 45-minute kind of journey, you know, through this story, literally in the shadow of the Washington Monument. I mean, like staring at it from stage. And it was incredible. And earlier that morning, we had gotten a chance, the whole group of us got a special tour of the museum itself. And I mean, it was just incredibly overwhelming and powerful and added so much weight to what we were about to do. And yeah, I mean, it was a once in a lifetime experience, truly.
Yeah. So what else is coming up for you now?
Man, I mean, there's going to be a lot of continued work on America Divided project. So the next thing that's going to come out is an EP project that I put together with Jazzy Jeff and the Playlist Retreat. And it is music inspired by the show. And it's Aloe Black, Raheem Devon, Rhymefest is on there, Maimouna Youssef. The possibility of a couple others that I'm not going to say yet.
Sure.
And there's a couple tracks that are produced by artists at the Playlist Retreat. Mm-hmm. So you've got everybody from, like, you know, Pomo, who, you know, people know from Anderson .Paak, Tennyson, like some sort of young up and comers. And, you know, really what it was we had this discussion about arts and activism, and then I challenged people at the retreat to, you know, go in and make music, you know, with this in mind. And the result of that is what's going to be on this on this EP, and it's especially exciting because people have heard a lot about the Playlist Retreat, but nobody really knows what goes on there, and this is sort of the first formal release of music from that, so I'm really excited for that as well because it's an incredible gathering.
Nice. And finally, you did this whole presentation with Josh Kuhn on the sort of crossfader as kind of metaphor for culture, as a way of understanding culture.
But then you might want to add a beat to it. From Isaac Hayes. And just like that, those two parts are combined to create something new. A Jay-Z and Alicia Keys track built on those two parts. Two become one without ever ceasing to be two.
For people who haven't seen the presentation, what is that?
You know, that's something that in the coming year, we're going to actually focus a lot more on. So we're going to try and take it to colleges this year, I hope. But, you know, it's sort of a hybrid lecture and DJ performance, which sounds crazy when you say it, but when you see it, you get it. It's kind of like a more talky version of what I would do on a mixtape, which is, you know, melding music in support of the points that are being made. And Josh talks about the origin of the crossfader, both in terms of hip hop and the technical aspects of it, but also how it's become a metaphor in his mind for America, that the traditional metaphor is the melting pot where all things melt into one and, you know, in some ways nullifying all the diversity that's there. So if you look at a crossfader, you have two separate and distinct turntables, and then you have this implement for controlling the sort of curve of what you hear out of each. And he thought of it as a better metaphor for describing what we all do, you know, melting cultures and blurring them together, but then being able to separate out as well. So, you know, we did this at TED Talks. We did this at South by Southwest for Grammy U. And it's a really, to me, a really exciting kind of approach, you know, to education. I mean, that you have, you know, a traditional lecture, you know, might captivate some people, might bore some people, but you put a DJ on stage who's, you know, mixing and cutting and scratching in a way that relates to the lecture, and suddenly, you know, people light up. Yeah. And so it's not something that we would take to the Roots Picnic and perform, but, you know, in academic environments, I think that it could be a really powerful, you know, teaching tool. And so that's another thing that you know, we're going to kind of be exploring more this year.
Awesome. Well, Jay Period, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Peace to the cipher. I'm out.
So after the interview ended, Jay and Sean got to talking, and they decided to add on two more stories about unreleased mixtape projects for Mary J. Blige and Tupac.
Yeah, so tell me about the Mary J. Blige tape and working with her. It sounds like she wasn't the easiest person to track down.
I mean, to be honest, Mary, working with her was incredible. I was actually, I want to say, after the Lauryn Hill mixtape, I was called in to the office of her product manager, who, as it happens, is now my manager. So that, you know, this is where the relationship started. But I was called into the office of her product manager, and she held up the Lauryn Hill mixtape and said, "I want this from Mary." I was like, "Absolutely." So the first step in that process was, you know, she sent this mixtape, or so she told me, to Mary, and said that she had heard it and that it was, you know, and she was down for the idea. So she has me fly out to LA to the video shoot for "Be Without You," and I go to the video shoot. I park my car and I'm walking up towards the house where the video is being shot. And, you know, this product manager, you know, God bless her, you know, will remain nameless for the purposes of this, says, "So, I haven't played the mixtape for Mary. You got to go in there and sell it." And I was like, I'd just flown across the country thinking that Mary had already, you know, was into this idea. And no, I had to go in there and sell the idea. So I went in with my Lauryn Hill mixtape, talked to her and Kendu, and she's like, "I love it. I'll listen to it. I love the idea. I'll listen to it." And, you know, that was the first seed for that. So, you know, then the next step in my mixtapes is to go and do the interview. I went to go interview Mary at the Mandarin Oriental in New York City. And at that point, I used a mini disc recorder. And we had probably the best interview I've ever done in my life. I mean, she was literally in a house coat with rollers in her hair and slippers on. And she was so relaxed and told the most amazing stories, which are still, you know, seared in my memory. But the great tragedy of that interview is I walked outside and went to go listen to the mini disc recorder, and it hadn't recorded any of the interview. And so I promptly took that mini disc recorder, threw it against the wall, and destroyed it into 1,000 pieces. Sure. And never used a mini disc recorder again. It then took me almost 9 months to get another interview with Mary. And I had to fly out again to L.A., meet her at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and conducted another interview. At that point, I had already done the majority of the mixtape. But, you know, what happened was really sort of crazy from there. I sent her the finished product, and I got an email back that was like, this is amazing. This should be my greatest hits. And I was like, okay, yes, you know, like 1,000%. So, you know, suddenly then this thing that was a mixtape has the potential to become her greatest hits. And there is a period of about 10 months of me, and think this is in 2007, of me flying back and forth to LA to have, you know, literally monthly meetings with the head of, then it was Geffen Records, maybe it was like the VP of Universal. And ultimately it was determined that the clearing of the samples on this mixtape would cost, I think, $2.5 million. I mean, it was three CDs and 120 songs, mm-hmm. and it was insane. I mean, it was like intense, you know? So talk about a catalog. So, you know, basically what happened is it then got shut down and it went back to being a mixtape. The problem was that when I, you know, went with the blessing of her team to put this out, there was a lot of backlash to, you know, putting it out. And I had only announced that it was coming out. I hadn't even put it out when I was, again, you know, sort of sent lawyers and the RIAA, and it was the month that Drama had been arrested.
For more information about DJ Drama's 2007 arrest, check out The Cypher episode 102 with Miami's mixtape king, DJ EFN.
And so they were going after people, and it was sort of like I had a choice of fight this publicly or maintain the relationship with the label that had led to this and, you know, just kind of try to quietly work it out. And I chose to kind of quietly work it out rather than blow up everybody's spot. The tragedy of this is that, you know, the Mary mixtape has never really seen the light of day. So, you know, we are still to this day trying to figure out with her team, you know, an appropriate way to put this out into the world. And God willing, someday, you know, people will be able to hear it. But yeah, the saga of the Mary mixtape was, you know, the first in this sort of series of steps towards putting out a mixtape as a proper, legitimate album, which now that we are at Hamilton, you know, is finally happening. So it's like a crazy story of it almost happening and not happening. But the mixtape itself, you know, is sort of epic and legendary if you have a chance to hear it.
Are there any other unreleased projects in the vaults?
There is one. I was asked to do a Tupac mixtape for the Broadway musical.
Oh, for the
play. Yeah.
For more information about the short-lived musical Holler If You Hear Me, check out episodes 71 through 73 of The Cypher, featuring the show's stars Saul Williams and Christopher Jackson, and its writer Todd Kreidler. Jackson, of course, went on to star in Hamilton.
And that mixtape was about to be released. We had put out the first single with the blessing of Afeni and the estate.
What was the song?
Dear Mama remix.
He was my son, and so I knew him and loved him as the mother would a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Spend it from school.
The play, sadly, you know, crashed and burned. And it didn't make sense to put out the mixtape anymore because it was not connected to anything. And so this has remained another sort of one of these epic legendary projects that I've done. And my approach to Tupac was I want a whole mixtape of the revolutionary Tupac. Like, you know, Tupac is two people. So I want to hear the Tupac that is the truth teller for 80 minutes. And that's basically the mixtape I put together. And it's bananas. And there have been so many times as, you know, these police shootings have gone on that I've wanted to release elements of that mixtape because they speak to exactly what is happening right now. And, you know, it's a testament to the timelessness of his voice. But, you know, God willing, that Pac mixtape will also see the light of day one day soon so you can all enjoy it.
I've known J. Period for a while now. He's actually been on the show before a few years ago. But this is the first time I've really gotten to sit down with him to talk about his life and work. As someone who is obsessed with connections and context, I'd naturally love his approach to mixtapes, and I'm so glad we got to find out what was behind it. And of course, it was amazing to hear the behind-the-scenes stories of the creation of the Hamilton mixtape, which I imagine many of you have been playing nonstop since it came out. Join us next week when our guest will be Tech N9ne. Tech is, of course, the co-founder of Strange Music, and a rapper who, despite having released albums since the 90s, seems to just be getting better and more popular. We'll discuss his whole wild ride, and also his brand new album, The Storm. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, listen to our interview with another key player in the Hamilton mixtape, producer Illmind, on episode 163. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For January, we're working on something very special for you. Become a patron by December 31st to get access to the file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of the episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
You know, he agreed to grant me a 15-minute interview.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Best sound check experience of all time.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
You know, it's massive, and so that became one of the challenges, but I think we did a great job.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
But that voice is actually mine.
Thanks to Patreon supporter Ryan Frizzell.
There's, in some ways, two kinds of DJs. There's technically sound DJs, and then there's DJs that are selectors.
And extra special Hamilton-related research thanks to Brian Weingartner.
Look at everything he influenced, going back and forth between Busta Rhymes and Sia.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
You want to do another final question in lieu of that?